You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Ray Cass, professor emeritus of art at Virginia Tech and founder and director of the Mountain Lake Workshop, an ongoing series of collaborative and interrelated workshops centered in the environmental, cultural, and community resources of the Appalachian region of southwestern Virginia. These workshops have resulted in many unique collaborative works of art that have been widely exhibited. Artists who have completed workshops at Mountain Lake have included, in addition to John Cage, the folk artist Howard Finster, Japanese artist and sculptor Jiro Okura, waste management installation artist Merle Lederman-Ukeles, ceramic artist, poet, and author M.C. Richards, Colorado-based eco-artist Lynn Hull, New York City East Harlem street artist James de la Vega, the Zen art scholar and artist Stephen Addis, and Paris-based sculptor and virtual reality light artist Jackie Matisse. And of course, Ray Cass himself. John Cage created 125 signed watercolors during 4-week-long sessions at the Mountain Lake Workshop between 1983 and 1991, all of which are beautifully captured in The Site of Silence, John Cage's Complete Watercolors, published by Ray Cass in 2011, just in time for Cage's centenary in 2012. During Cage's centennial year, Cass mounted a beautiful eponymous exhibition of Cage's watercolors at the National Academy Museum in New York, for which the book served as its accompanying catalog. Cass was a close friend and associate to not only John Cage until the time of his death in 1992, but for even longer to the Pacific Northwest artist Morris Graves, who Cage had met and befriended during his own years in Seattle in the 1930s. He is therefore the perfect person with which to have a conversation on the subject of Morris Graves, and thus Cage's text piece entitled Series Ray Morris Graves from 1973, which we featured last week on All Things Cage and continue this week. We'll dive right into my conversation with Ray Cass, then continue on from where we left off last week with Cage's series Ray Morris Graves, which, because of its length, spans 2 weeks of programs. Enjoy. So, Ray, you worked with Morris Graves, did you not, or were you just friends?
I worked closely with him. We were friends when I lived in Northern California, not that far from Lolita, where he lived. He walked into my studio early one evening and announced himself, and I knew of him and his work very well. And I said, Morris Graves, I thought you were dead. it's awkward. He certainly wasn't dead. And then Glenn Berry, a mutual friend, formally had us together at his house at Moonstone Beach in California. And after that, a friendship ensued, and I would visit him with some regularity. And I was invited by the Phillips Collection at a reception for an exhibition of my own work in Washington, D.C. in 1980 by James Laughlin, who was the chief curator at the Phillips Collection at that time. He invited me informally to curate a show for the Phillips Collection about Morris Graves, because Duncan Phillips was so enthused by the work of Morris Graves, and the Phillips had one of the biggest collections, you know. That's how I, after the Southern Photography show I did earlier in 1977, that's how I became an amateur curator, essentially. So I called Morris up and asked him about this, and he seemed okay with him. He said, you sound completely sincere, Morris. Morris was not somebody whose approval you could get very easily, but I went out in 1980 and spent that summer in Seattle and in Lolita, California at Morris Graves's place, and then in San Francisco, where I'd bring my, Morris would not allow me to record anything. He was a genuine recluse, and part of that was his self-awareness, because in a way, he was protecting people from himself, from his nature. which could have a short fuse and also could appear very worldly, could come across as very sophisticated individual, as his biography, the book I wrote about him, bears out, but needed to be alone. Robert Yarber, the Vedanta monk who took care of him and still takes care of that foundation, you know, would say, "Ray, you're too animated for Morris. It just wears him out. Sometimes just sit there and be quiet, even if you two don't talk about anything." Our relationship was back and forth like that over many years, because amazingly, and John Laughlin was right. I mean, I had access to him. Otherwise, there would not have been a Morris Graves retrospective in 1983. Nevertheless, he would periodically throw me out, you know, and I'd walk all the way around the house, this gorgeous place he created around himself, this compound. And Robert would let me in the side door, and I would just go back to work in the archive.
This was the place that they call the lake.
The lake, the last residence, where I remember arriving there. My visit in 1980 was a very consequential one, because I was really on my way to Seattle and Portland and other places. And beautiful fire burning in the fireplace. Beautiful, big, 60-foot by 20-foot wide room, maybe 18 feet, beautifully proportioned. The man was just a natural architect, designed all his own spaces, you know. And Morris isn't there. So I sit down on an old Chinese chair, and I'm looking out at the lake, which is all in mist. And suddenly I see appearing in the mist this gray shape. And it's Morris wearing a jalaba in a canoe, in a little boat, coming over to the main house. He had a 7,000 foot driveway in the middle of thousands of acres of land, which I think he had about 500. And he appeared. Whenever I would visit him with people of any importance, like the I went with Willem de Looper once from the Phillips Collection. We drove down the West Coast all the way from Seattle to Los Angeles, and we stopped and visited artists and people, and we visited Morris. The entire environment Morris lived in was overwhelming the way, in a very different way, Versailles is overwhelming. You know, you enter this huge palace through a door over here. The king is really only just over here. But to get to see the king, you're going to have to do the pavane. You're going to have to walk all the way around the building and then approach the room walking backwards. And there would be the king, and then leave the same way without ever looking directly at him. Mm. Well, Morris wasn't like that. But by the time you arrived at Morris's place, you were a little bit overwhelmed. I remember Willem telling me, "This man lives better than any rich man I've ever known." Hmm. It was such a beautiful environment.
Is that place still used as a residency?
Yes, it's used as an artist's residency, and you can apply by looking it up, the Morris Graves Foundation, and you write to Robert Yarber. And it doesn't come with a subsidy. It's a minimum of 3 weeks, sometimes longer. You can't use your cell phone.
Right.
But they make food for you.
Right. And it's one person at a time. Is that true?
Yes, it's one person, or I don't know if they make arrangements for a couple. It's you have a place to stay and a studio to work in. I'll say this about Morris. He was the genuine, he's the real thing, just like his talent. He's one of America's original draftsmen. He's self-taught, you know.
Right.
Beautiful work. And he's an American original in a lot of other ways. He did inhabit that character of the old man in the woods. And he was ambivalent too, because if he agreed to an event where people could come out, as on some occasions when I was there working with Robert Yarber, there would be something going on in the community that was a little bit focused on him, he would be reluctant. Then he would say, okay, people can come out between 3 and 4 o'clock. Exactly. And we'd get that all worked out. And then, of course, when the people were there, Morris would start enjoying it. And Robert and I would become, Robert less so than I, a little confused. What do we do now?
Right. Do you send them
away? Is he really enjoying this? Or, you know, is this going to be trouble later on or what? That would be very interesting.
You know, it sounds like that he was, that is to say that Morris Graves was a true introvert, which, you know, the real definition of an introvert is not that they dislike people. They're actually often some of the most charming and personable people, but that they find themselves losing energy to other people. That
he was absolutely an introvert.
Yeah, yeah.
And putting it, losing energy in social situations on other people, I can understand that. Sometimes he needed energy too, and he didn't always know when he needed energy.
Mm-hmm. Of course, of course. But it's interesting, Ray. I mean, it's interesting having you kind of in the center, if you will, being so close to Cage for as long as you were, and also being so close to Morris Graves as you were. And yet they each knew each other independent of you long before you came along.
Yes, they did know me independently, but the critical relationship that we developed, particularly John and I and Mersenal, Morris was so quintessential to that, because that happens. John Cage is somebody I would meet called in the middle of the night in Chapel Hill in 1976 because he was staying someplace and he wanted to play chess. And nobody could play chess. And the host happened to know I was in town and I played chess. So I went over and I didn't play chess with him. I played chess with Crete Sultan. And he watched several games. She was good, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
John was easier when you really played chess with him directly. It was always hard for me to concentrate fully on the game. Bruce, though, a number of students, you knew Bruce, but you knew there were other ones, would occasionally beat John. John mm-hmm. was never trying to win. I can understand that anecdote in which Duchamp
Marcel said that to him.
Got annoyed, saying, "You're not trying to win."
Yeah. And John said he was right.
Oh, yes. He said, "I'm just trying to spend time with you." Right,
right. Right. But do you think that Cage and that John Cage and Morris Graves actually had a closeness before they were older?
Oh, of course, because of Seattle. John was hired at the Percussionist, that they lived in the same building. They were real friends. And John appreciated Morris's Dada antics. You know, John would come home one day and Morris would be lying on the stairs with some red fluid and all pouring down the stairs like he'd slit his throat. Yeah. And I think they were very close in Seattle, and that's sort of the beginning of that enormous creative synergy that happened there. So unusual, but it's not unusual in history. It's like you have Toby, you have Graves, but you have the circle around Graves, some of whom, like Guy Anderson, are very significant people. You have Cage, and then you have Merce arriving as a teenager, virtually. You know, years before that, you have Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams and Louis Sukofsky as roommates together at Hamilton College. I mean, amazing. How does that happen?
Right.
What
right.
are the space people?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you knew Morris Graves from what year?
I met Morris in 1969.
Okay, so that was a long time prior to your getting to know Cage.
And I was only at Humboldt. I left Humboldt in 1972. So I met John in happenstance on a program for the Spring Fine Arts Festival in Chapel Hill in 1976. And Meredith Monk was there, Stan Brockage was there. And I went to all the events. I came down. I was the artist in residence at Virginia Tech. I drove to Chapel Hill and stayed with friends. That's when I was invited over to play chess. But I had gone backstage to try to talk to him after his reading. Murs did an amazing performance of the piece where he's wrapped in plastic and rolling around on the stage. Yeah.
Yes.
And John did a beautiful sonorific sound reading that I think was part of that, or even separate from that. I knew of him because Morris had invited John to dinner. John and Murs were in California. Morris, this is a complicated time because the last time John and Murs saw Morris was when Morris had just arrived back from India. He'd forgotten he'd invited them.
Right. I remember this story, John telling this story.
And you will never get, I've had versions of the story from all of them. I should have written them all down. I have Robert's version that John and Merce had been there for a couple of days, and John was cooking this stuff on the stove that Robert couldn't identify with, and Morris didn't expect them to be there, but Robert didn't necessarily anticipate that. The upstart of it all was it was pouring rain, and Morris managed to throw them out in the middle of the night where they had to go in and stay at the Eureka Inn.
Uh-huh.
So when I met John, we would occasionally share an anecdote or a story. 1976, an opening of Rauschenberg's in 78. Whenever I saw him, I had the opportunity, I would say hello to him and try to talk to him. I didn't know him at that point. I didn't have a purpose, a reason, you know?
Right. Did you talk with Morris about bumping into Cage? Was that of interest?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Morris had tried to have me to dinner that time, which would have brought us together in 1970. But that didn't happen. So after that, we talked frequently about Morris. I mean, when John would be at the workshop, he would want to talk sometimes a little bit about Morris, and I would relate to him the experiences I had with Morris over now the number of years.
Sure.
Remember, if the Hirshhorn Museum owned 10 paintings by Morris, they'd send him images of them wanting some commentary, not even looking for authentication. But Morris would write back to the Hirshhorn Museum, "I didn't paint any of these."
Oh, God.
Most of my life at that time was involved going to the Carnegie Museum, going to the Hirshhorn, inadvertently becoming an authenticator of things that I knew he'd painted.
Right, even though he claimed that he hadn't.
He would deny that constantly.
Yeah.
It was enfant terrible that way. But that he also was positioning me because he got, when we did the retrospective in New York in 1983, he didn't come to the opening at the Phillips Collection after all the effort, time, money. Marion Willard came, numbers of other artists like Theodore Stamos, all kinds of people came to that. Morris didn't come. Imagine how I felt. Mm. Yeah. But Morris came to the Whitney because Marion had the idea to have a birthday party for Blanchette Rockefeller.
Okay.
And she knew exactly what to say to Morris that would appeal to the part of Morris that his mother had brought up to be properly an aspiring person in society, but also to have that appeal, like having Thanksgiving dinner with the Duke and Duchess of, you know, I forget what, the king who quit being a king.
I see. Not the Duke and the Duchess of Windsor.
Yes. Morris won the first and only so-called annual prize in the arts that was awarded by the Duke of Windsor, and thus was there at their house and guest for.
And he was quite young.
What would have been Thanksgiving dinner, which they don't really celebrate.
He was like 26 years old or something.
No, because that didn't happen until the 50s.
Oh, okay. So he was in his 40s.
Morris's great debut happens when Dorothy Miller comes out to visit Marion Willard and gets taken out to his studio and is put in the Americans 42 show, 1942,
right,
I guess, and is the sensation of the exhibition.
Yeah. His biography, Ray, you know, to me anyway, reads like a dream. He's a young man. He knows what he wants. He's discovered.
He's got the talent.
He avoids the military just by the grace of his own.
He avoids it with long suffering. I mean, he was in the brig for quite a while.
No, I understand that.
He's shaving himself with a dull razor on the night he escaped.
Yeah. But it's just, it reads like some extraordinary story of success, really, on a number of levels.
It also gave him the impression this is what being an artist was for other people.
Uh-huh.
So we had, don't know that that's not true.
Exactly. I'm saying it's unique in my experience to read of someone who just has it so, in a sense, handed to him, you know.
Life could be but a dream. I could hold you up in paradise up above.
Exactly. So he was like that. He believes that this is,
And he was always running out of money. And the endless correspondence he was having with Marianne, with Marion Willard, was about money usually. Though she remained a very close friend to his for the rest of her life. He liked younger people rather than older people. Although he had two particular women in the community who were his age. In other words, he had a decent circle of friends, people he saw privately who had access to him. I wasn't in that category. I was in kind of another category. Who knows what this kid will do?
Well, I think it's just extraordinary that your life, you know, really included, you made a point of including Morris Graves and John Cage in your life in very significant ways, both of them, and that they actually see something of Morris Graves's work in not only John Cage's work, but in your work.
Yeah, well, I certainly acknowledge that. I think that was there even before I, well.
No, I'm sure it is. No, I'm
sure. I met him, but yes, you're right. One, tremendous feeling we had, nature as metaphor for everything. And the West, the space of the West couldn't be described. So you had to develop symbols and emblems to represent it. In his case, flora and fauna. And the extraordinary drawing abilities and techniques that they, thank God he was not a trained artist.
Because it would have all of that.
So much less.
That's right. It would have been buried. It would have just been pushed down.
Yeah. And his admiration for Cage was for John's, you know, presence, his utter originality. I can't imagine what it was like to know John in the 30s. John could never remember what year he went to Seattle in. First, he thought it was 1936. It was, I think it was 1937 when he arrived there. But it's still somewhat ambiguous to me. So writing about the both of them at different times, it was never easy to clarify that. Mm-hmm. We know that the Cornish School of Art has something to do with it because Graves worked as a guard at the Seattle Art Museum. He never graduated from the Cornish School of Art. He might have taken a class or two there. Nellie Cornish had a tremendously visionary, and I met her once at John's. I met other people at John's that went back to the Seattle years. I wish I could remember all of them. You probably have names.
Well, I know that Morris Graves was friends with Nancy Wilson Ross.
Of course, yeah.
As was John Cage. So they shared, you know, they shared a handful of people when they were there together.
And those women were essentially connected to Toby, so Mark Toby, the minute Morris had this sensational success, that if there weren't already frictions and anxieties, there just became more. That's what artists are like. There was mutual respect there also. I never knew Toby.
No, you never even met him.
Morris would pull a photograph out, and Toby would be wearing a blue suit. You'd go, there, look at that.
They couldn't have been more different. I mean,
what does he want me to look at? Remember, I'm just there doing my seemingly never-ending job, right? And I said, it looks like Mark Toby. He's holding a little flower in one hand and something in the other, and he's smiling. And he says, He's wearing that suit. That's what he was. That's what he was like. Huh. Always appropriate, always socially, appropriate attire for the occasion. And I thought, I was looking at the face and at the flower, and but
right,
you didn't contradict Morris when he was talking to you.
Well, you know, that's the feeling that one got. Not just the feeling, Cage conveyed this thing about Morris Graves that he was, in some sense, trying to be socially unacceptable, trying to be outlandish,
Well, that's all very true. He did some pranks all the time, like the uninvited party.
Yeah.
Too detailed to describe here.
Yeah, but isn't it
Seattle society to his house when he lived in Edmonds and just having sprinklers going over it, a table of all rotting food.
Oh, seriously?
Entered the foyer, yes. Oh. And that's as far as people got.
Yeah.
I don't think his things were always in really good taste, and they were somewhat passive aggressive. You know, he would arrive at Carolyn Kaiser's parents' house, Bullets, and walk right through the pond wearing his jalaba. He was a person who was always noticed. This is interesting. He's the introvert who has an obsession with extroversion within parameters.
No, that makes perfect sense. That is, in fact, the impression I got from Cage's sharing about Graves back then.
John wanted to talk to me once about that situation in Lolita when he threw John and Merce out of the house into this intense rainstorm. And mind you, when you're thrown out of the house, you're nowhere.
Right.
You're basically feeling your way towards your car in an environment like that, which is another 50 yards or more away.
Right.
And then you drive down a mile-long driveway.
But they hadn't seen each other in how many decades?
It had been a long time. It could have been a major falling out. What's interesting about John and how magnanimous he could be is when the show opened in 1983 at the Whitney, Merce and John came to it. And they were open arms, and this is knowing the history, and I've got it from Merce and I have it from John about the whole evening was sort of shocking, you know. And yet Morris not only got a big review for his show in the New York Times, they were covered on the front page of the Society page. Morris, I wasn't invited to the after opening dinner party. Yes, at Marion Willard's. At Morris's request, I was not invited.
Sounds like lucky for you.
Yes, Helen Hatch entered the elevator into the driveway and into the apartment, slipped on the floor and broke her leg.
Seriously?
They were the first arrivals.
Uh-huh.
They were my patrons in Seattle who put me up for the 2 summers I was there, paid for things, took care of me in every way I needed to do this research, introduced me to everybody in Seattle, Bagley Wright, Virginia Wright, everybody who Morris knew. And I would have to endure the conversations with all those people individually. For instance, I knew I was supposed to meet Bagley Wright one morning, but I didn't expect him to arrive an hour early. And there's pounding on the door. I opened the door. And he says, "Hello, are you Ray Cass?" And I said, "Yes, I am." "You're working on Morris Graves?" And I said, "I'm doing a project for the Phillips Collection." He goes, "I'm Bagley Wright. I want to tell you what he did to me."
You poor thing. God.
Endless. People would send me on wild goose chases because there was Toby group and there was the Graves group. And I had to figure out after a while who was telling me what I thought I wanted to hear and who was leading me down a trail to nowhere.
Wow.
I enjoyed that. That was 1980 and 1981.
Right.
And I thought John Ashbery was going to write the book or the catalog or whatever. I never written a book, you know. And as it ended up, the Phillips Collection called me and said, we don't have an author for this thing. Ashbery is in the hospital. It's really sick. He might die. AIDS was new. Nobody knew what he had. I went up to visit him. That was it. John Simon, the theater critic of the Times, came to visit Ashbery while I was visiting him. And just knowing John Simon's work, I mean, the acerbic tongue, the scathing things he could say about people, it's like, I was trying to figure out, how can I make my exit from this room? But it was beautiful because they obviously liked each other and cared about one another. So I did what Robert Yarber taught me to do. I turned into a ghost.
How old is Yarber now? And do you ever talk?
Yarber would be certainly in his middle 60s, mm-hmm. middle to later 60s, because he'd be about 10 or 12 years younger than I am.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yeah. And do you ever go out there? Have you been?
I haven't been back since 2009.
Okay, the same year that Merce died.
Yes, I think it was around that time.
Uh-huh. Why did you go?
I went every year for many years to paint, and I would usually see Morris once, usually arranged by friends or intermediaries. Morris kept tabs on me. If I was giving a talk in Tacoma or in Chicago, he knew about it.
Uh-huh.
He had a huge network. I don't know how he kept in touch with it exactly. Never had more than a telephone. I mean, we had nicknames for him, you know, friends of his and mine, dinner party Swami. Right. I mean, John Houston called me once, called me numbers of times, actually, about Morris Graves. He said, I'd like to go out and see Morris. Can you help me with this? So I arranged it. And he arrived with Eve Arnold, photographer.
Okay.
And you were never allowed to take pictures. I had some secret pictures, you know, photographs. But Eve Arnold lavishly photographed the property and Morris and the house and things like that. And John arranged for all this to be published in Paris Vogue.
Really?
Well, you can imagine who got blamed for this. Yes.
Did you try to, like, direct the attention to John?
I didn't direct the attention to John. No, this, yes, of course, John Houston, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Angelica played a role in this because I called a couple times. Angelica had a tremendous attachment to Morris Graves as a child in Ireland. And she loved him. She loved his work. And Ricky Houston, John Houston's wife at the time, was killed in an automobile accident, you know, was very close to Morris Graves.
Uh-huh.
So Houston himself knew Graves, you know. And Ray Stark was shooting Annie in Radio City Music Hall. I was interviewing Houston about Graves. And Ray Stark took John at lunchtime up to the Willard Gallery and bought him one of Graves' bird paintings from his current show.
Nice.
They bought two of them, in fact, at the time. Hollywood people.
Well, you have the most amazing stories about Morris Graves. I never expected all of this.
John always, he turned to me at the workshop. We were concentrated working on paintings, and he had asked me about Morris Graves, and I told him about the duration of our friendship and the closeness, but closeness insofar as I saw my role as very responsible and professional, you know. I told him how Morris would, something I would do would irritate him to the point he'd throw me out of the house. But then he always seemed to know where I was and what I was doing. And I was going to tell you, when he drove in from New York City to his retrospective on his way to meet Tom Armstrong, then the director of the Whitney, he said to one of my students who had picked him up at the airport, some people think Ray Cass is the real Morris Graves, but I'm a living artist.
Wow.
What a thing to share with one of my 22-year-old students or 21-year-old.
Of course, that must have been very confusing.
Yes, I would say entering that life world was to enter a situation of normal confusion.
I had no idea, Ray, just no idea. You shared most of this with Cade?
And John would ask me then, what was that like? I realized because I'd survived working with Morris was part of the reason, I think, John worked with me. And in that conversation, at one point, he said, do you know what he did to us? And it was just like that.
Yeah.
And that's when I got John's version of the being thrown out in the middle of the night. And later I had Merce's version. I had Morris's version. I had Robert's version. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
The versions.
Yeah. Was Merce's piece that used Morris's artwork, the beautiful little boat?
Inlets.
Yes, Inlet. What year was that relative to being thrown out?
1980-ish. I can't name the year.
But I think it was after, was it not?
It might have been after. Like I said, that I would need to look at the little pile of books I usually
have. Right. I'm going to look this up because I find that fascinating. You know, did they accept this invitation after John that happened?
Well, you know, John and Merce, as you know, were very unusual people.
Totally, totally.
And I think the friendship they had, Merce, John, Morris, went back so far. They were part of an art world, part of a life world, where they were all sort of very connected, and they needed each other, but they were also stuck with each other. The way you think sometimes of Rauschenberg and Johns, you know, especially reading Susie's obituaries and all. Mm-hmm. It's like, without Dorothy Miller, as Frank Stella said once, a lot of these things couldn't have happened. Uh-huh. She was Alfred Barr's assistant. She was the creative driving force at MoMA that put those extraordinary shows together and put the stamp Museum of Modern Art on them.
Uh-huh.
And that meant you're stuck together from now on.
It's a lovely world, isn't it? The art world.
There might be a million other artists in America, but you'll figure this one out. It might take you the rest of your life. Frank Stella seemed to figure it out pretty quickly. He said, without Dorothy Miller, you weren't going anywhere.
Interesting. So interesting. Well, thank you so much, Ray. I have no idea how much of this I'm going to be able to use, but I will keep you posted.
It's nice that it's archival footage someplace.
That's right. That's right. I may just air the whole thing, uncut.
I appreciate him more now. I appreciated him then. It was just hard to work with him.
Yeah.
I had to survive working with him. And to do that, I had to turn on and off in certain ways. And sometimes I wish I could just have an evening with Morris now, where we are in the universe.
Morris never married, right? He never had a partner and no children.
He had partners, but when I was writing the book about Morris, I couldn't write anything about his gay life.
Right, right.
Not only was that enforced by him, but by some of his friends. And then if I went to San Francisco, the person who was most interested in what I was learning from my interviews with Morris, I remember I couldn't record anything, so I'd go back to my room and I'd write everything down, was Wayne Thiebaud and Betty Thiebaud. So I would stay with them sometime, or I'd go to their house, they'd take me out to dinner. Wayne wanted to hear everything that had happened, transpired in the previous week or two.
Right, right. And
just man, just totally knowledgeable about all West Coast art, period.
Yeah.
Great artist.
I forgot my question. Oh no, was Morris Graves an only child?
No, one of six or seven.
Oh, really?
Yes. Well, five, six or seven.
A large family.
And he wasn't the youngest. Celia was the youngest. He was the second. He might have been the third from the youngest.
I see.
And, you know, his mother, Mrs. Graves, she wanted her sons to live like princes.
I see.
And so some of them did.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like he did.
Yes.
In his own way, you know, in his own way.
I think in many ways, you know, the Museum of Modern Art owns 38 pieces and they never show anything. The way they recently decided that Andrew Wyeth is not a modern artist. That's sort of preposterous, you know? Mm-hmm. But he has a definite place in history, a definite place in things, and a following. I'm surprised. I think it's because the work is so uniquely introverted and idiosyncratic. In other words, there's nothing manufactured about Graves.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
John, the philosophical scope is relevant to so many different communities.
Right.
So many people can relate to Cage. I think Morris didn't think John should have ever painted a picture, you know.
I'm sure. No, that would make perfect sense to me. But, you know, that the genuineness, I think that they shared. I think that was something that they both had about them. You know, why is it that Cage remains, popular is the wrong word, is so of interest to young people? What is that about? You know, they just see a video of him. And I've thought about this a lot. And I think it has to do with the genuineness of Cage, that it was
sincerity.
The sincerity.
Offering them an alternative.
Exactly. In a time of real manufactured personalities and, you know, you never know quite what you're looking at. And there's Cage. There's this, you know, scrappy looking guy in his Levi's who had an infectious laugh. You know, he was the real deal. And I sort of feel like Morris was that way as an artist, you know, that his art was absolutely this genuine thing that he made. It was,
absolutely genuine. He's certainly not a phony.
Yeah, yeah. So I think of them kind of that way. There's something very natural about both of them. And I can see how they would be friends.
And a powerful friendship, an important friendship. As you say, in my life, one thing led to another.
Uh-huh.
Now we have to bear the culture. And I'm perfectly happy to do it.
Okay, good, good. That's kind of how I felt about, all kinds of things, but Slonimsky being one of them.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a handful as well.
Okay.
Let's just say thank you, Ray. It's been a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Laura, for having me.
Now, continuing on with John Cage reading Ceres Ray Morris Graves from 1973.
Chainsaws, bulldozers, rototillers, powered lawnmowers, then terrace radios. Noise was unbearable. Three more. A yellow lower garment brings supreme good fortune, aristocratic reserve. Dragons fight in the meadow. Their blood is black and yellow. Inflation of earth principle. Lasting perseverance furthers. No advance. No retrogression. Change the shape of technology. Shape it to elude, to shape of a chalice. The amethyst would be as large as a 50-cent piece. On the very end of a gold-plated arm, 14 inches in advance of the body of the vessel itself. Talisman. Guide. Asking permission. Receptacle. The house is a receptacle. Each day begins the same way. Cup, morning shawl, the chair outdoors he sits in, facing the forest, the book, the bowl of cereal. Morris, immaculate, in tails, wearing sneakers. Jan in sequins, 20s style. Na bra brahm, nyan nyan, brahm, nyan nyan, brahman, nyan nyan. She could have helped him, but wouldn't. A few years later, the skin cancer which had been removed from his face, appeared in the same place on hers. In one junk shop, he found the base of the shaving mirror. In another, 10 miles away, the rest of it in the magnifying glass. You could tilt it. There were further postponements. We must keep in touch. He returned to Seattle, received the letter. His plan had been eliminated. No reason was given. Letter, mysterious energy, cable from Dorothy Norman, insufficient oxygen, you were very high. And do you sing and dance? Not with words, but with the sounds that language had before it began. He gave an example. Sometimes the words included chalices, each of us having spinal trouble. We slept and sat on boards. And laughter. Next year we'll be in wheelchairs. I was surprised when he told me that he was considering letting any and all of the hippies he'd met have land on the shore of the lake. No one will throw you out. She. Which is the most offensive aspect of technology? Its smell, the look of it, its effect on food and water, its sound? Or is it that anything anyone does with his hands seems useless in the face of technology's lava-like continuation? When the door was finally opened, there were drawings and paintings everywhere, on all the furniture, including the bed, on the walls and the ceiling. We had to walk carefully so as not to step on them. The table had not been cleared. There were scraps of food on the plates. Stem removed, an ilac shape remained. Bird waiting to be born. Deep in the ocean. If you descend to the uttermost depths, there you will find the gem of love. Go seek, O mind, go seek Vrindavan in your heart, where with his loving devotees, Sri Krishna sports eternally. Was Graves with us when the earthquake took place? All the people who had never met, even though they lived next door to one another, met then and there in the vacant lot, conversed with one another. Now there is no escape. Tanzania, Uganda, Egypt, the islands of Greece and Greece itself, Italy, France, New York. The king of Sikkim, Graves told me, has rare clarity of mind. He is a devout Buddhist scholar. His meditations are those of a guru. His conversation is not chit-chat. It conveys the best of his mind. The more closely attention is given, the more difficult it becomes to fix something by name or by relation to other things. It begins to move on into another being. Floor covered with sand, large tree trunk that had drifted up on the beach off-center in the room. Ice cream chairs in circle facing it. Cawing of the crows, patiently trained, made conversation impossible. They stayed where he'd placed them, on top of the driftwood. Communion, the blood. He wasn't a student. Why wouldn't they let him in the school? Gee, ta tagi, ta tagi, tagi, ta tagi. I suggested sitting down. He said that way he'd have to have other brushes. Unwashed dishes, temporarily put out of sight, in drawer lined with silver paper. He filled a baby carriage with rocks and with strings, made a trailer for it of toothbrushes. He pushed it downtown to the Olympic Hotel, through its halls to the main dining room. After placing a rock at each chair but one, he then sat down and ordered dinner, Seattle. They enjoyed an immediate friendship. They talked about the mystery of death, the nature of the next dimension. Before long, a certain lightheartedness entered into their conversation. He could not tell whether he was awake or dreaming, or whether what was happening was happening. Titan missile had been getting bad publicity. Two launchings had gone sideways into the ocean. Pentagon feared greater publicity would affect NASA funding. Nong ta, nong nong ta, nong nong ta, nong ta. Second, the soot and dirt are removed from the rooms. In this totality, the conscious mind is contained like a smaller circle within a larger one. Petroleum fire, USA, red, orange, Canada, forest green, ashes. Out of Gulf rose huge negresses moving like gorillas. Has he told you anything about the actual process of painting or drawing? Work periods are often very long, going through the night into the next day or days. He continues until the spirit leaves. Portico over the terrace was supported on one side by the house, on the other by handsomely rough sawed hexagonal tree trunks used as columns. There was a pool with lotus. The school's registrar was coming to lunch. Just when she was to arrive, there was a knock at the door. Xenia opened it. Morris, stark naked, was standing in the hall. Zosimus, and everything will be moistened and become desiccated again. And everything puts forth blossoms, and everything withers again in the bowl of the altar. For nature applied to nature transforms nature. All things hang together. Rah! They used rafts, piling on them duckweed and water strawberry that had grown too thickly, moving slowly from bay to bay. As they continued their work, more and more the sky and the forest were reflected in the surface of the water. Repeating what he had told was taken as an insult. He threw the cup of boiling tea. I was obliged to leave the room. The Duke and the Duchess. Photographer looks at you but snaps himself. Fisherman's transformed by what he catches. Three tables, or is one sufficient, providing it's large? The colors to the left, the brushes to the right, the paper directly in front, and the water? Surely it's here and there, right and left, ready no matter what. Minnow has put the egg back together again. Amazon-like demonesses and nearly naked. They were replaced by thousands of stick figures, ants moving through the ashes. Ra-ma, ra-ram, ra-ra-ram, ra-ram, ram, ra-ram, ram, ra-ram, ra-ra-ram, ram, ra-ram, ram, ra-ram, 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 ra. Surface of the water responds to the currents of the air and to birds. They're floating, their takeoffs, their touchdowns. My work is done. Now the telephone comes off the hook. Time for a nap before supper. The footman rolled out the red carpet up the museum steps. Lee, ka, ka, Yuga, Kali, Yuga, Kaliga, Kali, Kakali, Yuga, Kakali, Kayuga. We fly to place where no airplane is. Secluded house throbs with utilities. The wise man gladly leaves fame to others. He does not seek to have credited to himself things that stand accomplished, but hopes to release active forces. He was off stage left, invisible to the audience. After hearing his wail, people were mystified. They asked, how was that sound produced? Not who had sung it, but what strange instrument was it that had been used? Both of the windows are washed, Windex spray and paper toweling instead of soapy water and cloth. Variation is introduced, some outside, then some inside. How many windows are there? 102. Are you sure? Yes, I am sure. In the next box, the Princess Chichibu was sitting, Hirohito's sister. A student needed money for trip with girlfriend to Mexico. Morris gave it, then asked the young man for help on 4 weekends around the house. Student agreed to come at 9, arrived instead at 3, left at 5. Nobody here wants to work. As we went upstairs, I paused to admire the charcoal walls, their sheen and texture. He agreed they were beautiful. He said there had been a fire. Except in his bedroom, all the walls upstairs were black. For that reason, he had the house rent-free. Hong Kong, day after receiving vision, he heard of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Did both events happen at the same time? A shallow window next to the bathroom ceiling goes the length of 2 walls. It looks to the forest beyond, the garden and lawn. On its ledge are many more or less translucent containers, empty and having different colors. Bud lights, guest lists, they reached the museum before the governor did. I stayed in the flower market. He went to look for a shopping bag. I ate the hakima with lime juice and chili pepper. The bag he had had to buy was plastic. There weren't any others. Ka lung lanka, lung lanka, lung, lung lanka, lanka, lung lanka, lanka, lung lanka, lung lanka, lung lanka, lung lanka, lung lanka. Landlanka, Slanlanka, Landlanka, 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 Landlanka.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.